That was our whole world. The long line. Men strung out across the fields. The trusty shooter stalking the edge. The driver on his mule. The caller yelling to the sun, throwing his working song out like a fishing net. Us caught and struggling. Once my grandmama told me a story about her great-grandmama. She come across the ocean, been kidnapped and sold. Said her great-grandmama told her that in her village, they ate fear. Said it turned the food to sand in the mouth. Said everyone knew about the death march to the coast. That word had come down about the ships, about how they packed men and women into them. Some heard it was even worse for those who sailed off, sunk into the fire. Because that's what it looked like when the ship crossed the horizon. Like the ship sailed off and sunk bit by bit into the water. Her grandmama said they never went out at night. And even in the day they stayed in the shadows of their houses. But still they came for her. Kidnapped her from her home in the middle of the day. Brought her here, and she learned the boats didn't sink to some watery place, sailed by white ghosts. She learned that bad things happened on that ship, all the way until it docked, that her skin grew around the chains, that her mouth shaped to the muzzle, that she was made into an animal under the hot, bright sky, the same sky the rest of her family was under, somewhere far ways in another world. I knew what that was. To be made an animal. Until that boy came out on the line. Until I found myself thinking again, worrying about him, looking out the corner of my eye at him, lacking crooked like an ant that's lost scent. It's not until an hour later when I figure the shirt's as dry as it's gonna get in the human close car that I see it. A small bag so small two could fit in the palm of my hand. Secreted in the middle of my bundle of clothes. Like the dot of blood the size of a pin at the center of the yolk in an egg. Life that would have been life, but not. It's smooth and warm, soft to my touch. Feels like leather, and is tied together with a sinewy leather strip. I glance up, Misty is dozing in the front seat, her head falling forward and jerking upright only to list forward again. Leonie's got both hands on the wheel, her fingers tapping to the music on the radio. We're listening to country. Which I hate. We've been in the car a little over 2 hours, so we lost the black station from the coast at least an hour ago. Leonie smooths the hair at the nape of her neck with one hand, as if she could caress it into flatness. And then she taps again. I hunch over my lap, turning toward the door, making a small room with my body, a screen. I pull the strip, the knot gives, and I tease it open. I find a white feather smaller than my pinky finger, tipped with blue and a slash of black. Something that at first looks like a small chip of white candy, but when I pick it up and hold it close to my face, it's some kind of animal tooth, lined with black in the chewing grooves, sharp like a canine. Whatever animal it came from knew blood, knew how to tear knotty muscle. Then I see a small gray river rock, a little perfect dome. I swirl my pointer finger into the dark of the sack, searching, and pull out a piece of paper, rolled thin as a fingernail. In slanted, shaky script, in blue ink, keep this close. It's either Pop or Mam's handwriting. I know this because I've seen it all my life, on Catholic wall calendars, on the inside of a kitchen cabinet next to the refrigerator where they tack a list of important names and phone numbers, starting with Leonie's. On permission slips and report cards when Leonie was too busy or absent to sign. And because Mam hasn't left her bed in weeks and can't hold a pen, I know it's Pop who wrote the note. Pop who gathered the feather, the tooth, the rock, who sold the leather pouch, who says to me, keep this close. My knees rub the seat in front of me. I can't help it. I've gotten tall enough that the back seat of Leonie's hatchback is close and tight. Leonie glances in the rearview. Stop kicking the back of my seat. I hold my palms, a warm open bowl, over the things that Pop has given me, which are in a tiny pile in my lap. I ain't mean to, I say. You should have said sorry, Leonie says. I wonder if Pop ever did something like this for her when she made this trip before. If he snuck out in the morning when Leonie was sleeping at 9 a.m. or 10 a.m. and secreted something in her car. some little collection of things he thought might be able to keep her safe. To watch for her when he couldn't. To protect her on her trips to North Mississippi. Some of my friends at school have people living up there, in Clarksdale or outside of Greenwood. What they say? You think it's bad down here? What they do? Frown. What they mean? Up there, in the Delta, is worse. Up ahead, the trees by the side of the road begin to thin, and there are suddenly billboards. A picture of a new baby in the womb, a red-yellow tadpole, skin and blood so thin the light shines through it like a gummy candy. Protect life, the sign says. I put the feather, the rock, and the tooth in the bag, roll Pop's note so thin it could be a straw for a mouse, and put it in the bag before tying it shut and putting it into the small square pocket sewn into the waistband of my basketball shorts. Leonie is not looking at me anymore. Sorry, I say. She grunts. I think I know what my friends mean when they talk about North Mississippi. Pops told me some parts of Richie's story over and over again. I've heard the beginning at least too many times to count. There are parts in the middle about the outlaw hero Kenny Wagner and the evil Hogjaw that I've only heard twice. I ain't never heard the end. Sometimes I'd try to write them down, but they were just bad poems. Limping down the page, training a horse. The next line, cut with the knees. Sometimes I got fed up with Pop. At first, he told me the stories while we were awake at night in the living room. But after some months, he'd always seem to tell me part of his Richie story when we were doing something else. Eating red beans and rice, picking our teeth with toothpicks on the porch after lunch, sitting in front of the television in the living room watching westerns in the afternoon. When Pop would interrupt the cowboy on the screen to say this about Parchman. It was murder. Mass murder. When Pop told me about the small pouch he kept tied to one of his belt loops, it was cold outside, and he was splitting logs for the wood stove that heated the living room. We were out of gas for the weekend. Mam had all the covers in the house on her. Crocheted blankets and quilts and flat and fitted sheets, and she still moaned. My bones. Her hands tucked up under her neck, wringing one against the other, the skin raspy and chafed white. Even though I lotion them every hour, it's so cold. Her teeth rattling like dice in her mouth. Everything got power, he hit a log. My great-granddaddy taught me that. The log split. Said there's a spirit in everything. In the trees, in the moon, in the sun, in the animals. Said the sun is most important. Gave it a name. Abba, but you need all of them, all of that spirit in everything to have balance, so the crops will grow, the animals breed and get fat for food. He put another log on the stump, and I breathed into my hands, wishing I had a hat for my ears. Explained it to me like this. If you got too much sun and not enough rain, crops will wither. If you got too much rain, they rot in the ground. He swung again. You need a balance of spirit. A body, he told me, is the same way. The logs fell. Like this. I'm strong. I can split this wood, but maybe if I had some of the boy's strength, a little bit of wild pig's tusk at my side, something to give me a little bit of that animal spirit, then maybe, just maybe, he huffed, I'm better at this. Maybe it come a little easier to me. Maybe I'm stronger. He split another, but never more than I could handle. The boys share so much, and I take so much. No waste. Waste rots. Too much either way breaks the balance. He rested his axe on the ground. Give me another log. I returned from the pile, put the wood on the stump, balanced it just so, snatched my hand away as Pop brought the axe down clean through the center of it. Or a woodpecker could share something too, a feather for aim. My fingers stung from the nearness of that blade. How close Pop come to my hand. That's what you keep in your pouch? I asked. I noticed his small pouch when I was 4 or 5, and I asked him what he kept in it. He never told me. Pop smiled. Not that, he said, but close. When that next log split, I looked up at Pop and shook. I felt that splintering in my baseball knees. My bat spine, my glove of a skull. Wondering what power he had running through him, where it come from. I lay my head on the seat in Leonie's car, rubbing the pouch Pop gave me, and wonder if he ever gave a small sack full of things to balance to anyone else. His brother Stag? Ma'am? Uncle Given? Or even the boy Richie? And then I hear Pop. Richie wasn't built for work. He wasn't built for nothing, really. On account he was so young, he ain't know how to work a hoe. Didn't have enough years in his arm for muscle, or to know how to break the earth good, or to pull just enough power to clean the bowls from a plant instead of leaving little half tufts of white, ripping the cotton in two. He wasn't like you. You already filling out, getting longer through the shoulders, longer in the leg. You built like me, like my papa. Good stock. But whoever his daddy was must have been skinny, weak-muscled, maybe short. He was a bad worker. I tried to help him, tried to break his line when he was hoeing, dig a little deeper in his grooves, reach over and clean his plants better when he was harvesting, pull his weeds, and mine. And for a while, a few months, it worked. I was able to save him, kept him from getting beat. I worked myself so hard, I was asleep before my body even hit my bunk. Sleep on the fall. I kept my eyes on the ground, ignored the sky. All that open space pushing down that made fear gather in my chest. A bloated and croaking toad. But then one Sunday when he was doing laundry, scrubbing our clothes on the washboards with soap that was so weak everything smelled a little less like wet stink, but still didn't smell good. Kenny Wagner rode by with the dogs. Kenny was an inmate caretaker for the dogs. He was a legend even then. I knew about Kenny. All of us did. They sang songs about him in the hill country of Tennessee, down through the Delta, all the way to the coast. He bootlegged and brawled and stole and killed, had the truest shot I ever saw. Even though he had already escaped parchment once, one of them break-proof prisons in Tennessee, too. They still put him over the dogs, even though he put more than one lawman in the dirt. Poor white people all through the South loved him for it, loved him for spitting in the eye of the law, for blinding it, for being lawless in the lawless South, which was worse than the frontier for standing like David in the Old Testament place, where for a century before parchment, law had been meted out like this, JoJo. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Hand for hand, foot for foot. I think even the sergeants respected him. Anyway, Kenny and some of the men he chosen to help him was on their way to drill the dogs, to train to scent. And one of the men that ran with the dogs was dragging. Maybe he was sick. Maybe he had been whipped. I don't know. But the short man fell and his dog broke loose, ran away from his dusted over face, his receding belly, and ran to me, hopped around me like big barking rabbits, let their tongue hang. Kenny, who was a big white man, 6'3", probably damn near 300 pounds, laughed, told a black man on his knees in the clay, "Nigga, you more trouble than you worth," and then pointed one of them big sausage fingers at me and said, "You look skinny enough." I hung the pants I was wringing on the line on the way over to him. Took as much time as I could, because he was the type of man who expected me to run. To look at his big, healthy whiteness in awe. When I came, the dogs came with me, ears flopping, big black eyes rolling, happy as pigs and shit. "Can you run, boy?" Kenny said. I looked up at him. His horse was big and dark brown, but with a red tinge. Looked like you could see the blood boiling just under his coat. A river of blood bound by skin, knit together with muscle and bone. I'd always wanted a horse like that. I stood close enough to Kenny so he'd know I'd come, but far enough away he couldn't kick me. "Yes," I said. Kenny laughed again, but there was a knife underneath. Because then he turned them blue eyes on me and said, "But do you know your place?" Shifted his rifle so the muzzle was facing me, a great black cyclops eye. I let him think what he would about my place, but I said, "Yes, sir," and hated myself a little bit for saying it. "One of them dogs licked my hand. They like you," Kenny said, "and I need myself another dog trustee." I didn't say nothing. Animals had always come to me. Mama said one time she left me wrapped in a basket on a chicken stump out in the back when I was a little baby, not more than a month, and stepped inside to get a sharpening stone for her knife. When she came out, one of the ghosts was licking my face and my hand, like it knew me. So I just looked at the top of Kenny's head, his bushy blonde hair. He looked at my neck and he said, "Come on," and turned his horse and kicked and took off. Once we tracked a gunman through 10 miles of swamp to an abandoned cabin, and I saw Kenny put a bullet through that running gunman's head at 200 yards. The gunman's skull burst. Kenny had killed him as the sun was going down, so we camped next to a stream. The clouds rolled in. The night was twice black, fog with mosquitoes. We smoked the fire. All the inmates working with Kenny and the dogs leaned into it. Everyone but me and Kenny. I muttered myself to help with the bites. The smoke bored his face, melted it to nothing. But I still felt him watching me in the darkness. Knew it when he stopped his story about how a woman sheriff had caught him in Arkansas, sent him back to Parchman this last time, and then said, "I can never hurt a woman." They knew that. And then his gaze is on me. I look right back. "Everybody got a line. Something to break them," he said. I thought about Richie scrawling through the dirt with his hoe. "Everybody," Kenny said, and spat chew into the fire. When I wake up, it's mid-morning and Leone done pulled off the highway. The Atlas says we should take Highway 49 all the way up, deeper north, and to the heart of Mississippi, and then get off and drive a ways to get to the jail, which Leone has marked on the state map with a black star. But we're not following the map anymore. We pass a grocery store, a butcher, a sagging building with a flat roof and a faded sign, Lumber Wholesale. The building's thin and the trees thicken until we're at a stop sign, and there's nothing but trees. And when we roll through the intersection, the road turns to dirt and rocks. "You sure you know where we're going?" Leone asks Misty. "Yeah, I'm sure," Misty says. It stopped raining and the air is fuzzy with fog. Misty rolls down the window and holds her cell phone out. Aside from the chug and pull of Leone's car, it's quiet. The trees are still and tall. To the left of the car, the trunks are brown and healthy. The undergrowth sparse. To the right of the car, the forest looks recently burned. The trunks are black halfway up, and the undergrowth is thick and bright green. I wonder at the stillness of it all. We are the only animals rooting through. "Ain't shit out here," Leone says. "If I could get a signal, I could call him and ease your mind, but we too far out." Misty wipes her phone on her shirt and slides into her pocket. "I've been here before with Bishop. I know where I'm going." "Where we going?" I ask the front of the car. Leone half turns, so I can see her frown at Misty before she turns to the road. "Gotta stop for a minute, see some friends," Misty throws over her shoulder. "Then we get back on the road." We round a bend and there's a gap in the trees, and suddenly we are among a little cluster of houses. Some have siding like Mam and Pop's, some have insulation paper and no siding. One is an RV that looks years off the road, with wisteria draping along the top and crawling down the side. It's like the thing has green living hair. Chickens run in bunches as a dog. A pit bull with gray-blue fur and a gaping maw chases them. The chickens scatter. A boy, probably 4, is sitting on the ground in front of the porch steps of a house with no siding, and he is stabbing the mud with a stick. He wears a baby onesie that fits him like a shirt, yellow underwear and no shoes. He wipes his hand across his face as Leone comes to a stop and turns off the engine, and it turns his skin from pale milk to black. "Told you I knew where we was going," Misty says. "Blow the horn." "What?" "Blow the horn. Ain't no way I'm getting out this car with that dog running loose." Leone blows, and the dog, who has stopped chasing the chickens and trotted around to the car to sniff the tires and pee on them, begins to bark. I know what he says. "Get out. Inhale, get out. Inhale, trespasser, get out." Kayla wakes up and starts to cry. "Take her out," Leone says, so I unbuckle her. The little white boy waves his stick in the air and then grabs it with both hands, pointing it like a rifle. His blonde hair sticks to his head, curls into his eyes like worms. "Pow, pow," he says. He is shooting at us. Leone cranks the car. We don't need this. Yes, we do. Cut it off. Blow the horn again. Leone compromises. She doesn't cut the car off, but she does blow the horn again. One long, loud honk that makes Kayla cry harder and burrow into my chest. I try to shush her, but she can't hear me over the barking dog, the shooting boy, the silence in that clearing in the pines. A sound as heavy, as loud as the others, but not. I want to jump out the car with Kayla, and I want to outrun that boy and his dog and that fake gun, and I want to walk us all the way home. My insides feel like they want to fight. A white woman steps out the door of the house with no siding, steps past the dirt-faced child. The hair is the same blondish-reddish color, with the same curliness. Hers is long, down to her waist, and except for her nose, which seems swollen in her face and burns red. She's prettier than Misty. She's also barefoot. Her toes are pink. She coughs, and it sounds like a scraping in her throat, and walks toward the car. The dog runs up to her, but she ignores it. At least it stops barking. Misty opens the car door and sticks the top half of her body out while holding on to the frame. "Hey, bitch!" Misty says. It's like a term of endearment. The woman smiles and coughs at the same time. The mist is settling like dew on her hair, turning it white. Told you we was coming. The boy is still shooting us with the stick gun while the dog licks his face. I want to run back home. Leone drags her hand through the hair over her right ear, scratching at her scalp. She does this when she is nervous. You gonna make yourself bleed, ma'am told her once, but I don't think Leone realizes when she does it. She scrapes so hard it sounds like nails pulled over canvas. Misty is hugging the woman, who is staring into the car, when Leone opens her door and steps out and says, "Hey," I barely hear it over Kayla's crying. She scratches again. The little boy hops up the concrete steps and disappears into the house. When Leone walks up to the woman, and all three of them begin talking to each other, her hands hang weak jointed at her sides. The floors are uneven. They are the highest in the middle of each room in the naked house, and then slope down to the foreshadowed sheathed corners. The inside of the house is dim through the porch, which is crowded with boxes, so all that's left is a walkway into the living room, which is also dim and crowded with boxes. There are two sofas here and one recliner, and this is where the shooting boy sits. He's eating a pickle popsicle. The television sits on top of a box instead of a TV stand, and is playing some sort of reality show about people who buy islands to build resorts. "Through here," the woman says to Misty and Leone, who follow behind. Leone stops me with a raised arm in the living room. "Y'all stay here," she says before leaning forward to touch Kayla's nose with her pointer finger and smile. Kayla's face is still wet with tears, but she's sniffing and holding on to my neck and staring at the shooting boy as if there's something she wants to say to him. So I let her down. "I'm serious," Leone says, and then follows the woman and Misty into the kitchen, which is the brightest room in the house, lit by a chandelier hanging from the ceiling laden with bulbs. There's a curtain hanging over the doorway, and the woman pulls it halfway shut and coughs and motions at the table for Misty and Leone to sit. She opens the refrigerator. I sit on the edge of the sofa so I can watch the shooting boy in the armchair and Kayla, who is squatting feet before him with her hands in her lap, and the gap in the curtain where the women sit in the kitchen. "Hi," Kayla says, drawing the word out so it's two long syllables, her voice rolling up and down a hill. It's the same thing she says to her baby doll when she picks it up the first thing in the morning, the same thing she says to the horse and the pig and the goat, and the same thing she says to the chickens, the same thing she says to Leone when she first sees her, the same thing she says to Pop. She won't talk much to Ma'am. When I carry her in the room to see Ma'am's still body, Kayla shrinks into my chest and shoulder, puts her brave face, and after 5 minutes of cringing away from Ma'am and saying, "Shh," with her finger in front of her lips, she says, "Out." She never says hello to me. She just sits up and crawls over me and puts her arms around my neck and smiles. The boy looks at Kayla like she's his dog, and Kayla hops closer. "Hi," she says again. There's a worm of snot running down the boy's face. He jumps up to stand in the recliner, and he seems to make a decision because he smiles, and his teeth are all capped with silver, the metal stopping them from rotting out his mouth. He begins jumping in the chair like it's a trampoline, and a few of the boxes stacked to the side of the chair wobble. "Don't get up there, Kayla." "They'll both fall out, I know it," Kayla ignores me and swings one leg up and pulls herself into the chair, where the two begin talking to each other and jumping, having a conversation. I catch words, chair, TV, candy, all gone, move. I cup my hand around my ear, look at the women in the kitchen, watch the way their mouths move, and try to hear. I was asleep. That's why I didn't hear y'all at first. We all been sick back here. It's the weather, Misty says. One day it's freezing, the next is in the 80s. Damn Mississippi spring. The woman nods, drinks a plastic cup of something, clears her throat. Where Fred? Misty asks. Out back working. Business still good? It's booming, baby, the woman says, then coughs. Leonie is whirring the table with her hands. The warmer it gets, the better it gets. You still got me, Misty says. The woman nods. Y'all want something to drink? She asks. You got a cold drink? Misty asks. The woman hands her a Sprite. I remember how thirsty I am, but I won't say anything. Leonie would kill me. No thanks, Leonie says. And the only reason I know it's what she said is because I read her lips and the shake of her head. She speaks so low. You sure? Misty asks her. Leonie shakes her head. We need to get back on the road soon. There are cases of cold drinks stacked up against the wall, Coke and Dr. Pepper and Box and Fanta. When we drove up, I never would have imagined this much plenty in one house. It is stuffed with it, so much food and so many things, so much bulk, cases of soup, cases of crackers, cases of toilet paper and paper towels, 3 microwaves still in the box, rice cookers, waffle makers, pots. So much food, the boxes of it reach to the ceiling in the living room. So many appliances. They are as tall as the lights in the kitchen. I'm hungry and thirsty, my throat a closing hand, my stomach a burning fist, and Leonie at the table. Leonie who doesn't usually care whether we accept food when it's offered. Leonie who normally would take everything given to her with an open hand, now she says no. Now when the goat and rice I ate is silt in my gut. The woman crosses her arm over her chest and frowns. She's trying to keep the coughs inside, but they come out in sputters. She shakes her head, and I know what she's thinking because I can see it in the way she's standing and staring at Leonie. Rude. If Pop was here, he wouldn't call this boy no rascal, wouldn't call him a scalawag neither. And he definitely wouldn't call him boy. He'd call him badass. Because he is. He's tired of playing Kayla's game of chase, so he stopped running. He crouches in front of the television, turns on one of his 4 game systems, and begins playing a game. It's Grand Theft Auto, and he doesn't know how to play it. He drives the car over medians into stores, gets out of the car at stoplights, and runs. Kayla is bored. She walks back over to me and climbs into my lap, grabbing a bunch of my shirt and begins talking to me seriously about wanting juice and graham crackers. So I can't see the women. Can't see the glass of water that Leonie drinks now that she's been bullied into accepting something. Can't see Misty and the woman leaning towards each other over the table, whispering to each other, drawing pictures on the table with their fingers. The boy is screaming at the television, his video game has frozen. No, no! He yells in a voice that sounds like his nose is stuffed with snot. The boy's car is sailed off a road that winds around a cliff. The car has jumped the railing but is frozen in the air. The car is red with a white stripe down the middle of it, splitting it in two. The boy punches the buttons on the controls, but the game does nothing. Take it out, the woman yells from the table. No! Start it over, the woman says, and then bends toward Misty again. The boy throws the controller at the television. It hits and clatters to the floor. He bends and begins fiddling with the game station, pressing buttons, but nothing changes. Don't want to lose my spot, he yells. The women ignore him. Kayla jumps up from my lap and bends to pick up a blue plastic ball from the floor, about the size of 2 of her fists, and starts playing with it. If you take it out, it won't lose your spot. It'll save it, I say. I know this not because I have a game system, but because I played Michael's when he lived with us. So I know how they work. He took it with him when he left. The boy ignores me. He make a sound halfway between a cry and a growl in his throat, something gurgling and whiny. And when he comes up in front of the shelf of the game systems, he doesn't stand or turn around and begin playing with Kayla again. He doesn't grab another ball off the floor, a black one or a green one or a red one, all that I can see, and roll one towards us. He stands up and punches the TV. He hits it with his right hand first, and then his left, and then his right, windmilling his arm so that his small fists connect with the plastic so hard it sounds like it's cracking. It is cracking. His fist hits it again, and there's a firework on the car that bursts and stays, one shot through it white and yellow and red. He hits with his left, and it does nothing. And then he hits with his right again, and there's a firework burst on the car. It stays. "What are you doing?" the woman yells from the kitchen. She's half risen from the table. "You better not be messing with them boxes again." The boy hits again with his left. Nothing. "What I say?" the woman yells, and she's all the way standing now. The boy bends to the floor, grabs the t-ball bat, and swings. There's a loud crunch and the sound of glass and plastic cracking, and for one moment, the entire car is one brilliant burst of fireworks, and the TV winks black, and there's nothing on the screen, but before the screen there are the woman and the boy. She stalks past Kayla, who runs and launches herself into my lap and grabs my shirt with both hands and corners the boy in front of the TV. He turns with the bat and whacks on the left leg with it. "Motherfuck!" She half coughs and screams and then grabs the bat from him. She picks up the boy by one arm and holds the bat with another and yells, "What did you do?" Each word is a swing. Each swing makes the boy run. He shrieks, "What did you do?" The boy's legs are red wherever she hits him with the bat. He laps the woman like a horse on a merry-go-round, his face like that, open mouth, grimace, rictus. She hits him so many times his cry goes silent, but that mouth is still open. I know what he is saying. "Pain, please, no more pain, please." The woman drops the bat in the boy's arm all at once, the bat dropping in straight line to the floor, the boy sagging into a heap. "Wait till your daddy come out the shed, he's gonna kill you." Leonie walks across the living room and takes Kayla from me, and when she walks, she looks at Misty, who still stands in the doorway of the kitchen holding back the sheet. "We really gotta get back on the road soon." "He'll be in soon," the woman pants. "Y'all got a bathroom?" I ask. "It's broke," the woman says. She's sweating and wiping her hair back away from her face. "We use the toilet in the shed, but if you got to pee, it's best you go do it out in the yard." When I walk out, the boy has crawled back into his recliner, and he has curled himself into a ball and is crying noisy tears. Kayla reaches for me when I open the door, but Leonie holds her in a tight hug and walks back into the kitchen with her, away from the crying boy and the shattered television, as if that is what she needs to protect Kayla from. The woman's already there, drinking a cold drink, shaking her head. "This the second one he done did that to," she says. "It's called birth control," says Misty. The woman coughs. The front yard is still cloaked in mist, still empty. The dog has disappeared, but my hands still burn when I run to the car. The sweat coming in spikes with the fear of teeth. Nothing chases me to the car where I open the doors on the driver's side to make a shield and pee by the driver's seat. I half hope Leonie will step in it. I zip and ease the door shut, wonder where all the people that live in this small circle of houses are. Nothing comes for me when I glance at the house, study the closed front door, or when I creep around the back. There's a shed there, brown with a dark tin roof, papered like the house with weatherproofing liner, but no siding. There's a light coming through slits in one of the windows, which have been blacked out with aluminum foil. Someone is listening to country music inside, and when I put my eye to the slit, I see a shirtless man with a beard. He's tattooed like Michael, but he has shaved his head. There are tables with glass beakers and tubes and 5-gallon buckets on the ground and empty cold drink liter bottles. And I know I've seen this before. Know that smell because when Michael built his lean-to in the woods behind Mam and Pop's house, it looked and smelled like this. The reason he and Leonie fought. The reason he left. The reason he's in jail. The man is cooking. Moves as easy and sure as a chef. But there's nothing to eat here. My stomach burns. I sneak back around to the front of the house, fingering Pop's bag in my pocket, wondering if the tooth is a raccoon's. If it makes me so quiet and quick that even the dog won't hear me when I circle around to the front of the house and ease inside. When we leave 15 minutes later, I'm not nervous and I don't sweat. Misty's trying to act like she's not holding a paper bag tucked into a plastic bag, her arm straight as a yardstick at her side, the bag crinkling and hissing when she walks. Leonie looks everywhere but at Misty. She doesn't hand Kayla off, but instead buckles Kayla in herself. When we pull away from the sad circle of houses, with all that plenty inside, Misty is bent down fiddling with Leonie's floor mats, and the bag disappears. I slide a pack of saltines and two bottles of juice I stole out of that house into my own plastic bag. After we leave the half-burnt room of pine trees, and we're back on pavement in the highway, Leonie turns on the radio and lets it play louder than she ever has. I open my stolen bottle and drink the juice down, then pour half the other bottle into Kayla's sippy cup. I hand one cracker to Kayla and slide one into my mouth. We eat like that, one for me, one for her. I let the saltines turn mealy and soggy on my tongue before chewing and swallowing so I don't crunch. I am silent and stealthy in another way. Neither of the women in the front seat pay us any attention. When I eat and drink, I've never tasted anything so good.
Chapter 4. Leonie. The night of JoJo's birthday, Misty said, "If we do this, the trip's paid for. And then, you and Michael could have enough for a deposit. Y'all could get your own place. You always say the problem is y'all parents. Yours because you live with them. His because they're assholes." Given was even more still when she said that. Like stone, through Misty's narrow kitchen window, I could see the tops of the trees turning from a dark velvet gray to orange, from palest orange to a pink, the color of the inside of my mouth. "How you think I paid for all my trips up to Bishop? From tips?" She shook her head and snorted. "You better take advantage." I hear them four words over and over again when we get in the car, and I watch Misty put the package in the pocket under the floorboards. "You better take advantage." She said them words as though decisions have no consequences when, of course, it's been easier for her. The way she said it, "take advantage," made me want to slap her. Her freckles, her thin pink lips, her blonde hair, the stubborn milkiness of her skin. How easy had it been for her whole life, to make the world a friend to her. Before Michael went to jail, he installed the envelope in the bottom of my car. He elevated the car on a jack and crawled underneath with his welding tools, and he cut what looked to be a perfect square in the floor of the car, then inserted another piece of metal with a hinge, fixed the hinge, and then welded the bottom of the car back together. "Two doors," he'd said, and then kissed me twice. "One to hold, and the other to let it go. If I need to." He'd been home from the oil rig for 6 months by then, and we'd had to move back in with Mama and Pop. We'd run through the money he'd saved, plus his severance. He'd worked on the Deepwater Horizon as a rig welder. After it blew up, he came home with his severance money and nightmares. At the time, I talked him into buying a full-size bed for us to share in our new apartment, so no matter how we moved, I said, we'd sleep close. So every time he kicked in his sleep, every time he twitched or mumbled and threw up his arms, drawing back from something, I woke. I spent the days after the accident with JoJo in the house watching CNN, watching the oil gush into the ocean and feeling guilty because that's not what I wanted to see. Guilty because I didn't give a shit about those fucking pelicans. Guilty because I just wanted to see Michael's face, his shoulders, his fingers. Guilty because all I cared about was him. He'd called me not long after the story broke on the news, told me he was safe, but his voice was tiny, corroded by static. Unreal. I knew those men. All 11 of them. Lived with them, he said. When he came home, I was happy. He wasn't. "What we supposed to do?" he asked, taking two bites of his grits before leaving them to jelly on his plate. "We'll figure it out," I said. When he started getting skinny, I thought it was because of his nightmares. When his cheekbones started standing out on his face like rocks underwater, I thought it was because he was stressed out over money. When his spine rose under his skin, a line of knuckles punching up his back, I thought it was because of his grief and the fact that he couldn't find another welding job anywhere in Mississippi or Alabama or Florida or Louisiana or the Gulf of Mexico. But later I found out the truth. Later, I learned he'd figured everything out without me. You don't have to be so nervous, Misty says. I'm not nervous. This ain't the first time I done this. I know. I'm talking about with Bishop. Misty's sipping on one of the cold drinks she took from her friend's house. The woman's name was Carlotta, and her husband, the one who cooked and gave us the bag, was Fred. First time I did this was when I was visiting Sunny, my ex. That's how you know them? Yeah. First time I did it, I was scared to death, like you. But then after that, each time was easier. I glance in the rearview mirror. Michaela's shoving a blue ball in her mouth and babbling around the ball at her brother, who is trying to coax it away from her, his face very close to hers, his voice low and serious. Now don't put that in your mouth, Kayla. It's nasty and done been on the floor. Michaela grins and spits the ball in his hand and begins clapping and saying, Nasty, that's nasty. Jojo looks like he's paying all his attention to Michaela, but I know he's not. There's something about the way he leans, about how he says the same thing to Michaela. Again, that floor was nasty. That makes me realize he's listening to what we're saying, even as he's trying to look like he's not. Me and Misty already talked about it when I picked her up. We're not going to refer to it by name, not going to use any words that hint to what's in the bag, what we're sneaking north with us. Meth. Crystal. Crank. We talk around it, avoid it, like a bad customer in the bar who's too drunk for more, who smells like sweet alcohol fermenting and diesel, yet keeps grabbing my hand when I walk by, saying something fucked up to me like, One more, you sweet black bitch. And when we have to call it some other name, we're going to call it the most embarrassing thing we can so Jojo will lose all interest. If we get pulled over and they find those goddamn tampons, Misty, I'm going to kill you. I figure that will make Jojo stop listening. Never mind the fact that the statement doesn't make any sense. He's a boy, and periods are one of those things about the human body he most likes to ignore. Kidney stones, pimples, boils, cancer. Jojo, I need the Atlas. I'm right. He jerks when I say this before rooting around for the book and handing it over the seat to me, trying to find my eyes in the rearview mirror. When his brown don't find my black, Misty takes it from him. He shrinks back into the back seat, still looking at the floor. Michaela calls him. Jojo! And he leans toward her again. Where are we? I ask. I'm looking, Misty mumbles. I look for mile markers. We stopped at Carlotta and Fred's just north of Hattiesburg, in North Forest County. Mendenhall. We're in Mendenhall, Misty says. There's a stoplight ahead of us, so I slow. She's not looking at the Atlas. How you know that? Misty points up and there's a billboard. Mendenhall, it reads. Home of Mississippi's most beautiful courthouse. I want to see it. The light turns green. I step on the gas. I don't. Why not? What if it's really pretty? In the back seat, Jojo is moving his mouth around like he's chewing something. He looks away from Michaela and up to me, and his eyes dark as mine. I was smaller when I was his age. Weedier. More delicate at my joints and bones. He looks like Given, but he never jokes. Sometimes, when Jojo's playing with Michaela or sitting in Mama's room rubbing her hands or helping her turn over in the bed, I look at him and see a hungry girl. I bet it has big columns and everything, probably even bigger than Beauvoir, Misty says. No, I say, and leave it at that. Michael never used to write me anything about the violence in jail, those things that happen in the dead of night in dark corners and locked rooms, the stabbings and the hangings and the overdoses and the beatings. But I told him he had to tell me, In a letter, I said. If you don't tell me what's going on, I imagine the worst. So in the next letter, he told me about somebody getting jumped in the showers, beaten purple and black. In the one after, he told me how his cellmate started messing with one of the female guards, how they snuck around and have sex in the jail, hunching like rodents, bent on procreating. And in the next letter, he told me about the guards beating an 18-year-old boy who had been convicted of kidnapping and strangling a 5-year-old girl in a trailer park. They heard him screaming, and then nothing, and then got word he bled to death like a pig in his cell. That, I want to say to Misty, is your pretty courthouse. But I don't say anything. I watch the road roll out before me like a big black ribbon, and I think about Michael's last letter, before he told me he was coming home. This ain't no place for no man, black or white. Don't make no difference. This a place for the dead. Michaela's sick. She was quiet for the first hour after we left the house, but then she started coughing, and the tail end of the cough caught in her throat, and she gagged. For the past 30 minutes, she's been crying and fighting with her seatbelt, trying to get out. I hand a palmful of napkins to Jojo, and every other time I look in the rearview mirror, I see him bending over her, frowning, wiping at her drooling mouth. The napkins soak in seconds. We were supposed to drive the rest of the way today and stay with Michael and Bishop's lawyer in the next town over from the jail, but all her crying is making me feel like someone is squeezing my brain tighter and tighter. I can't breathe. Then she coughs and gags again, and I look back and the front of her is orange and mauve. She's thrown up all her puffy Cheetos, digested soggy, all her little careful bites of her ham sandwich. The meat has turned what isn't yellow-pink. Jojo is holding napkins in both hands, frozen. He looks scared. Michaela cries harder. We gotta stop, I say, as I pull over on the shoulder of the road. Oh, shit, Misty says, and waves her hand in front of her mouth like she's shooing away gnats. That smell is going to make me throw up. I want to slap her, even though the smell of the stomach acid, harsh and intense in the small car, makes me feel queasy too. Want to yell at her. Bitch, how you work around all them drunks and can't stand a little throw up? But I don't. Once we're on the side of the road, and I'm swiping globs of the vomit away with the napkins I snatched from Jojo, the queasiness turns flips and somersaults in my stomach like a kid on a trampoline. Jojo doesn't look scared anymore. He puts both hands in the vomit cascading down Michaela's front and unbuckles her chest harness. She pauses in her frantic straining, her little chest pushed out against the belt again to give a thank you cry before she starts pulling at the lap buckle, anxious for him to undo that too, to free her. He's frowning. He unbuckles the last buckle and pulls her out. And before I even have a moment to admonish him, to say his name sharply, say, Jojo! Michaela is smashed to his chest, and her little arms are around his neck again, the length of her laid along him, shaking, mewling, him breathing. It's all right, Kayla. It's all right, Kayla. Jojo got you. Jojo got you. I got you. Shh. You almost done? Misty asks, tossing it over her shoulder to the back seat like a piece of gummy burger wax paper. I'm tired of this shit, I say. I don't know why I say it. Maybe because I'm tired of driving. Tired of the road stretching before me endlessly. Michael always at the opposite end of it. No matter how far I go, how far I drive. Maybe because part of me wanted her to leap for me, to smear orange vomit over the front of my shirt as her little tan body sought mine, always sought mine, our hearts separated by the thin cages of our ribs, exhaling and inhaling, our blood in sync. Maybe because I want her to burrow into me for succor instead of her brother. Maybe because Jojo doesn't even look at me. All his attention on the body in his arms, the little person he's trying to soothe, and my attention is everywhere. Even now, my devotion, inconstant. I mop up the rest of the slimy residue in her seat, throw the napkins on the asphalt, take a few baby wipes and swipe them across the seat so that it smells like stomach acid and flowery soap. "It smells better," Misty says. She's half-leaning out the window of the car, her formerly fluttering hand now cupped over her nose like a mask. The drive to the next gas station seems miles, and the sun breaks through the clouds and beams directly overhead. When we pull into the parking lot of the station, the attendant is sitting on the front porch of the wooden building smoking a cigarette. She almost blends into the wall she leans against, because her skin is as brown as the stained boards. She opens the door for me and follows me in, and the string of silver bells hung across the door jingles. "Slow day," she says, as she slides behind the counter. She's skinny, damn near as thin as Mama, and her button-up work shirt hangs on her like a flat sheet spread to dry on a clothesline. "Yeah," I say, and wander toward the drink coolers in the back. I palm two bottles of Powerade and set them on the counter. The woman smiles, and I realize she's missing her two front teeth, and a scar meanders in a scratchy line across her head. I wonder if she just has bad teeth, or if whoever gave her that forehead scar knocked them out. Misty's walking around the parking lot, holding her phone above her head, searching for a signal. All the car doors are open, and Jojo is sitting sideways in the back while Michaela climbs over him, rubbing her face into his neck and whining. He caresses her back and their hair is molded to their heads. I pour half of a bottle into one of Michaela's juice bottles and hold out my arms. "Give her here." "Kayla, go," Jojo says. He isn't looking at me or the damp day or the empty road, but at Kayla, who begins to cry and grabs at his shirt and holds so tightly, her little knuckles turn white. When I pull her into my lap and sit in the front seat, she plants her chin in her chest and sobs, her eyes closed, her fists tucked under her chin. "Michaela," I say. "Come on, baby. You need to drink something." Jojo is standing above me, his hands shoved into his pockets as he studies Michaela. She doesn't hear me. She hiccups and wails. "Michaela, baby." I put the nipple of the sippy cup in her mouth, and she blocks it with her clenched teeth and whips her head to the side. I grip her harder, trying to hold her still, and her little milk muscles give under my fingers, soft as water balloons. We wrestle like this as she stands and sits and bends backwards and writhes and says two words over and over again. "No, Jojo." I've had enough. "God damn it, Michaela! Can you get her to drink some of this?" I ask. Jojo nods and I'm already handing her over. Without her, my arms feel weightless. Michaela drinks a quarter cup, and then she slumps over Jojo's shoulder, one arm around his neck, rubbing. I wait 15 minutes, and just as Misty is buckling herself into the driver's seat so we can get back on the road, Michaela vomits again. It is electric blue, the color of Powerade. "You might as well take that off," I tell Misty. She rolls her eyes and unbuckles her seatbelt before squatting on a parking block in the shade to smoke a cigarette. "We're going to be here for a minute." I don't want Michaela to throw up in the car again, to retch in the back seat while I'm strapped in the front. We just have to pull over again so I can clean her up. The heat rises from the asphalt parking lot, along with steam from the rain. Jojo sits sideways, his feet on the ground, Michaela draped over him. "You want to lay down, Kayla?" he asks. "Might feel better if you lay down." He slides his hands under her armpits and tries to ease her off of him and onto the seat, but she sticks to him. sure as a burr, her arms and legs thorny and cleaving. He gives up and rubs her back. I'm sorry you feel sick, Jojo says, and Michaela begins to cry. He rubs her back and she rubs his, and I stand there, watching my children comfort each other. My hands itch, wanting to do something. I could reach out and touch them both, but I don't. Jojo looks part bewildered, part stoic, part like he might start crying. I need a cigarette. I squat next to Misty on the concrete block and bum a smoke. The menthol shores me up, stacks sandbags up my spine. I can do this. I wait until the nicotine laps at my insides like a placid lake, and then I go back to the car. Make her drink more, I tell Jojo. 30 minutes later, she vomits that up. I give her 15 minutes, and I tell Jojo again. Make her drink. Even though Michaela is letting out a steady whine now, bewildered at the cup in her brother's hand, Jojo does what I ask. 20 minutes later, she vomits again. Michaela is desolate, hanging on Jojo, blinking at me when I stand inside the car door with more electrolytes. Make her drink, I say again, but Jojo sits there as if he does not hear me, his shoulders hunched up around his ears like he knows I'm out of patience, like he knows that I want to hit him. Jojo, I say. He flinches and ignores me. Michaela rubs her snotty nose and leaky mouth in his shoulder. Jojo, no, she says. The attendant steps out onto the porch, her cigarette already lit. Y'all all right? She asks. Y'all got something for vomiting? For kids? She shakes her head and her straightened hair flies free at the temples, waving around like insect antennae. Nope. Owner won't stock nothing like that. He say only the basics. But you'd be surprised how many people come through here car sick, needing Pepto-Bismol. Weeds are flowering in bushes at the edges of the gas station lot. Purple and yellow and white blooms nod at the edge of the pines. I palm the back of Michaela's neck where she slumps over on Jojo, who is sitting on the trunk of my car, jiggling his knee and watching me and Misty, frowning. Hold on, I say, and walk off the parking lot and along the tree line. Mama always told me that if I look carefully enough, I can find what I need in the world. Starting when I was 7, Mama would lead me out in the woods around the house for walks, and she'd point out plants before digging them up or stripping their leaves and telling me how they could heal or hurt. The wind moved high in the trees, but nearly everything was silent below, except for me and Mama, who said, That right there is cow parsnip. You can use the young leaves like celery when you cook, but the roots is more useful. You can make a decoction for cold and flu, and if you make them into a poultice, you can ease and heal bruises, arthritis, and boils. She dug around the roots of the plant with a small shovel she carried on her walks, and then pulled the whole plant up by its leaves and doubled it up before putting it into a bag she carried across her chest. She searched the ground until she found another plant and said, This pigweed ain't good for any medicine, really, but you can cook with it. Use it like you use spinach. Got a lot of vitamins in it, so it's good for you. Your daddy like it sautéed with his rice, and he say his mama used to make bread with the ground-up seeds. I ain't never tried that, though. On our way back to the house with the day's haul, she quizzed me. As I grew older, it was easier for me to remember, to answer her quickly as we picked our way around tree roots. Worm seed, I would say. Good for getting rid of worms if you use it like seasoning in food. But it was hard for me to remember everything. Every day, Mama would point out a plant that had parts that could help women. Specifically, seeing as how it was mostly women that searched her out, needing her skills and knowledge, she'd say, Remember, you can use the leaves to make a tea that helps with cramps. And it could bring on a period, too. I'd look away and roll my eyes to the pines, wishing I were in front of the TV, not out trudging through the woods with my mama talking about periods. But now, as I walk through the clearing and peer into the woods,